Iran has granted emergency use authorization for its first domestically developed coronavirus vaccine known as Coviran Barakat. Palestinians react to the election of Naftali Bennett as the new Israeli prime minister. They say Israel is a colonial entity and their demands remain the same. A military base in the Iraqi capital Baghdad, which hosts U.S. troops, reportedly comes under a drone attack. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behram Sajafi. Good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, Iranian health minister says that the country's first domestically developed vaccine has received emergency use authorization. Said Nemeki says the vaccine, named Coviran Barakat, will be mass distributed as of next week. The health minister also said that the second Iranian vaccine, which is a joint project by Iran and Cuba, will receive the approval for use by next week. The minister noted that Iranian-made vaccines are among the most effective ones with the least side effects. Coviran Barakat received emergency approval after completing the third phase of its clinical trial. Iran began its national vaccination campaign with imported vaccines in early February. More than 4.7 million people have received the first dose of the vaccine across the nation. Tehran says negotiations on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal have not yet reached their end, urging Washington to act and make a decision. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says that legal and technical discussions are going on in Vienna, and the session is unlikely to be the last round. He said it's too soon to talk about the results of the negotiations and that the remaining issues need political decisions to be made in the capitals of the negotiating sides. He urged the U.S. to accept its mistake in pulling out of the accord and make a decision. Khatibzadeh also rejected the statements by the leaders of G7 that claimed Iran's missile program to be in violation of UN Security Council Resolution 2231. The spokesman said that the resolution has not placed any restrictions on the Iranian missile program, urging the G7 leaders to fulfill their failed commitments instead. The third and final presidential debate has ended with seven Iranian candidates laying out their plans as regards to people's concerns and the ways to address them. However, some other subjects, such as foreign policy, were also brought up in the three-hour debate show. Yusuf Jalad reports.
For the last time, the seven presidential candidates stood toe-to-toe at the headquarters of Iran's national television, the IRIB, to face off for the third and final debate. While the debate was themed with people's concerns, it was derailed every once in a while toward other issues, such as foreign policy, a topic toward which the two camps of the principalists and the reformists have conflicting stances. The debate saw the two pro-reformist candidates, Abdel Nasser Himati and Mohsen Mehranizadeh, stressing the need for Iran to join the Paris-based Financial Action Task Force, or the FATF, a global intergovernmental organization tasked with combating money laundering and terrorism financing. Iran and North Korea are the only two countries in the world that have not signed up for the FATF.
Mr. Jalili, only you and North Korea are saying that the FATF is useless. Are you saying the 200 countries around the world which signed the FATF do not understand that it's useful or not? The FATF is meant to contain money laundering and terrorism. Please think twice before making any comment.
Said Jalili, a heavyweight principalist, called Iran's entrance into the FATF an irreparable mistake that completes the puzzle of sanctions by the West and the U.S.
Entering into some international conventions is a mistake. You agree to enter into the FATF, but then they will decide the next step for you.
But he did not elaborate on his stance during the debate. Along with other journalists, I waited outside the debate studio to investigate his take on the FATF and how he would treat the international convention should he become the next Iranian president.
The Iranian government has already signed an action plan with the FATF. Rouhani has agreed that Iran implement 39 out of the 41 articles of the FATF. Iran did comply with those 39 articles, yet that organization has approved only 16 of them. Furthermore, the FATF has made an announcement that if Iran fulfills the entire 41 articles, still it would define the next step for the country. Iranians need to know about these facts.
as part of Iran's action plan with the FATF. Initially agreed upon more than 6 years ago, the country had to finalize four pieces of legislation. Two were passed by a reformist-dominated parliament, but the incumbent principalist heavy parliament has halted the approval of the two remaining bills and referred them to the arbitration body, the Expediency Council, whose secretary is another presidential runner, Mohsen Rezai. Rezai says any decision regarding the FATF now is tied to whether the U.S. would lift its anti-Iran sanctions as part of the ongoing Vienna talks between Iran and the parties to the nuclear deal over the revival of the 2015 accord. This is how the upcoming presidential election could shape Iran's foreign policy. Iranians will go to polls on June 18th to choose their next president.
While many Iranians are still undecided on a single candidate, the debates have helped them to narrow down their choices. But the question of who will be the next Iranian president will be answered on June 18th. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran has unveiled a new domestically made destroyer and a mine sweeper in the southern port of Bandar Abbas. The destroyer, called Dena, is the latest Samoj-class frigate fitted with different defensive and offensive systems. It's capable of sailing long distances in open water. The warship has a flight deck for choppers. It can detect, counter, or destroy aerial and marine threats. Iran also inducted the Shaheen Mine Countermeasures Vessel into the Navy in the same ceremony. The full indigenous vessel uses the latest technology to detect and neutralize sea mines. President Rouhani, who took part in the unveiling ceremony via video conference, has hailed achievements despite international pressure.
Today, we witnessed the unveiling of two warships. The vessels have been made over the past years, proving that no pressure, no war can make us surrender. We'll continue our path. The strength and capabilities of Iran's armed forces are for deterrence and defense. We never sought any offense against other countries, and we never will.
Well, Rouhani said the power of the Iranian military is used to support the country's neighbors. It's not going to be used against them. The president also hailed the independence of Iranian armed forces, their advanced capabilities, and development projects. Iranian Defense Minister Amir Hatami has hailed the successful completion of two new vessels joining the Navy fleet. He says the aim is to increase regional security.
We're making great equipment, and they can shoot from under the water. We have cruise missiles of ours that are now flying over 1,000 kilometers. We have great radars being built in this country, a host of military, a large number of military hardware and ordnance, all of which are being deployed on the Dena vessel and also the minesweeper. Well, they're also joining the Navy, and hopefully our Navy will be, Navy's power will be further boosted both in terms of offensive and defensive operations and rapid reaction. Hopefully, we'll be able to bring security and protect our borders for Iranian borders and waters and also those of the region. In light of this security and tranquility, hopefully, economic development will also be possible. I would like to offer you congratulations again. I congratulate the respected Iranian people and the Iranian Navy.
Now, when it comes to acts of sabotage against Iran, especially its civilian nuclear program, it's been an open secret that Israel has been responsible. It has included cyber attacks and assassination of scientists. Recently, the outgoing head of the Israeli spy agency, Mossad, revealed in so many words that Tel Aviv was behind the recent attacks targeting Iran's nuclear program and also the assassination of a top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. This is the closest admission yet by Israel.
Since 2010, Israel has been linked to at least a dozen of attacks on Iran's nuclear program. These operations were aimed at disrupting Iran's progress in the field of peaceful nuclear technology through acts of sabotage targeting Iran's nuclear facilities and assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. Between 2010 and 2012, four Iranian scientists, Masoud Ali Mohammadi, Majid Shahriari, Dariush Rezai Nejad, and Mohsen Ahmadi Roshan were assassinated, while another scientist named Fereydoun Abbasi was wounded in an attempted murder. Also, in November 2020, another top Iranian nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was assassinated in a roadside attack. Iran blamed the killing on Israel and condemned it as terrorism. Tehran also slammed world bodies for their silence on the acts of terrorism targeting the Iranian nation and its elite personalities. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv neither confirmed nor denied its involvement in the attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and scientists. However, last week, Israel's Channel 12 aired an eye-opening interview with former Mossad chief Yossi Cohen, who led the spy agency for more than 5 years. Yossi Cohen hinted at Tel Aviv's involvement in two explosions over the last year at Natanz nuclear facility, as well as the assassination of a prominent nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. He also shamelessly threatened Iranian scientists involved in the country's nuclear program with death. That's while Israel has always pursued a policy of deliberate ambiguity over its nuclear capabilities, as well as the issue of targeted killings and airstrikes. Iran's mission to the United Nations slammed Israeli lawlessness, saying that Cohen's comments reflect Tel Aviv's long-standing strategy of criminal sabotage against Tehran. Cohen's interview is aired as talks to revive Iran's nuclear deal are about to resume amid hints of progress. The Israeli regime has been the nuclear deal's strongest opponent, although the United Nations, the European Union, and others have hailed it as a diplomatic success.
Over the years, Israel has cried foul at Iran obtaining a nuclear bomb. No one can forget when the Israeli Prime Minister held a placard at the UN with a cartoon-like magic marker drawing of when Iran would obtain the bomb, which he falsely claimed would be in less than a year. Israel also made that false claim in the years 1992, 1995, and also 2002.
Iran has repeatedly complained about Israel's attacks, with Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Kazem Gharibabadi, warning as recently as Thursday that the incidents not only will be responded to decisively, but also certainly leave no option for Iran but to reconsider its transparency measures and cooperation policy. Gharibabadi also slammed IAEA's silence in the face of terrorist attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities and the assassination of scientists. Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of the weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program and assassinated several Iranian nuclear scientists in recent years. However, Iran has rejected all these accusations, as it was among the first nations to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and it has been under the most intense scrutiny and inspection by the IAEA than any country in the world. That's why the Israeli regime itself has, under constant U.S. protection, avoided joining the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and is now in possession of hundreds of nuclear warheads and other non-conventional weaponry.
Israel is saying that it claims a right to commit any act of murder or sabotage against Iran that it wishes. But what Israel doesn't realize, and what Israel's American backers don't realize, is that that these kinds of actions virtually force Iran or other such countries to take equivalent measures against Israel and the U.S. So they're opening up a Pandora's box by opening the international scene to all kinds of acts of murder, sabotage, revenge, etc. And every country will claim the right to do so, and they'll cite Israel as an example. So, as I said, Israel is playing with fire here and is going to get burned because equivalent measures will be taken against it.
The revelation of outgoing Israel's spy agency that Israel was behind recent attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and its top scientists shows that it has no respect for the law. That's while Israel has followed a deliberate policy of ambiguity for years. It seems favoritism towards Israel by the International Atomic Energy Agency, as well as Washington's invariable support for the regime, has given it the green light to break international law. Isn't it high time for the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes?
Now let's move on. Palestinian officials have reacted to the election of Naftali Bennett as the new Israeli prime minister. They emphasized that the change will not affect their stance vis-à-vis Israel. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is saying that regardless of the shape and the color of the new administration, Israel does remain a colonial and occupation entity. Hamas' spokesman Fawzi Barhum says the Palestinians will resist to get their rights back. A spokesman for Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas also emphasized that the changes won't alter Palestine's position. That's always been a Palestinian state on the basis of the 1967 borders with Jerusalem al-Quds as the capital. Now, those reactions came after the Israeli parliament vetoed in favor of a new coalition cabinet, ending Netanyahu's 12-year tenure as premier. Now, right-wing Naftali Bennett will lead the new cabinet for 2 years before his centrist ally, Yair Lapid, takes over. Moving on, a U.S. military base in the Iraqi capital has reportedly been targeted by an unmanned aerial vehicle. A security source says that a drone hit Camp Victoria, hosting American troops at Baghdad International Airport. No casualties are reported. The targeted attack was runways of military cargo aircraft. No claim of responsibility either. Camp Victoria had come under similar attacks in the past. The U.S. military logistics and diplomatic buildings have been increasingly targeted in Iraq recent months amid growing anti-America sentiments. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Economic divide.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide. I'm your host, Kovit Tafley. Every baby that is born brings with it promises of advancement and development for where they are born, which in some ways contributes to the economy. But what if that population was on the decline in a very major way around the world? Well, that is the topic of this edition of Economic Divide. Some of the headlines of this program: population stagnation, fertility bust, fact or myth? Have deaths started to exceed births? We will be checking out the numbers and see which countries are suffering from this, and of course, its economic impact. Then, the era of high fertility. Is it ending? But why? Is it because women have gained more access to education, perhaps, and contraception? Maybe migration to urban cities is the cause, or is the reason purely economical? In order to take a look at that, our next highlight is going to be case studies. We're going to be taking a look at countries Which countries are suffering the most from declining populations? Is it China, which just allowed couples to have 3 children, or Italy, where maternity wards are shutting down? And Japan, well, has long been facing declining birth rates. And finally, one continent is going against the wave of low childbirth, and that is Africa. Countries there are outpacing the rest of the world, like in Niger, 7 children per woman, followed by Mali and Senegal. But believe it or not, these countries are on a downward trajectory.
The world population is always growing. The young and the old intersect paths. One group enters the workforce, the other retires. New ones enter this world, and the cycle continues. Most thought the world population had peaked, but there were warnings that it had entered a declining stage. Imagine entire regions where everyone is 70 or older. Imagine governments laying out huge bonuses for immigrants and mothers with lots of children. Imagine a gig economy filled with grandparents and Super Bowl ads promoting procreation.
There's a general viewpoint that a world with less people would be less burdensome on some key areas. Well, for starters, it is perceived that less people means more resources would be available. Climate change will not be as severe, and the impact on the environment would be less.
Just as significant as the increase in numbers is the fact that the global population is aging. Across the globe, the distribution of the population by age is shifting upward from younger to older ages.
But there's another side to the story when it comes to low fertility or fewer babies being born. It could actually have a detrimental effect on society. Fewer babies being born into this world would eventually translate into fewer workers. This would then mean that there would be more retirees. Just think about it. This could potentially turn societies upside down. The notion that a surplus of young people will drive economies and help pay for the old.
The majority, as I said, of the disaster displacement that we recorded is 98% of it is weather-related. So we can only expect, with the future impacts of climate change, for these disasters to become more frequent and more intense in the future, and therefore for the numbers of internally displaced people to grow.
Well, the population is declining, not increasing. The myth that the population is exploding and the world is overwhelmed with people is just not true. The declining population growth is all over the world. Just looking at the stats here, continent-wise, Europe's population is expected to decline the most by the year 2050, while Africa is expected to have the strongest population growth of any region. And the economic impact? That should be looked at through the lens of declining working-age populations, where you can see the projected change. European countries like economic powerhouse Germany and then Italy, for example, are declining, with Japan registering the most in Asia. But the OECD countries, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which comprises of 38 countries, shows a positive trend, even though that number is also in dispute. We have been covering how population decline can pose a threat to the world and its economy, but we haven't covered how that trend can be reversed. For that, let's go with Russia, since they're doing all that they can to prevent their population from decreasing. Boosting the national birth rate, well, that's a top priority for President Vladimir Putin, who has made this one of the key issues for his presidency, including cash incentives. For the country that tops the list in pushing countries to have, or pushing people to have children, that country is Sweden. Now, these are the stats which shows how determined the government is to increase its population. 480 days parental leave at 80% of earnings. Child benefits are 130 euros per child per month, increasing with each child. Now, you would think that would help the fertility rate. Believe it or not, it has not. The fertility rate in Sweden has actually fallen from 2.1 children per couple from 1990 to 1.6 for the year 2020. We're headed for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere. We have plenty more coming up. Before we go for a break, here is a story of a man from Pakistan and his children, not one, not two. Well, it opens a window into why there is a rise and fall of populations around the world. In this case, a big rise.
Since we have low literacy rate in the country, so therefore our growth rate is comparatively higher than the developed country's growth rate. and we have more population increase with the passage of time as compared to the developed countries. Definitely, we need to educate the population, educate the masses to have a reasonable size of the family size so that all these requirements could easily be met and your resources should be there to meet their requirements.
It's time now for a Q&A. Let's bring in Paul Sheldon Foote. He's a professor of accounting at California State University. His publications include biometrics, Sarbanes-Oxley compliance, and SAP ERP systems. Well, Paul, welcome to Economic Divide. Taking a look at what the New York Times has said, planted with fewer people could ease pressure on resources, slow the destructive impact of climate change, and reduce household burdens for women. But the census announcements from China and the U.S. have showed slower rates of population growth in decades, also pointing to hard-to-fathom adjustments. Can you name what some of those adjustments may be?
Well, it's easy to claim that, yeah, if you have fewer people around, that's fewer resources needed per person. But as I noted, if you have fewer people around and they're not marrying and they want separate houses or separate apartments, that takes resources. And we have the improvement of medical technology, people living longer. Well, people living longer have huge medical expenses. Also, they want to retire at young ages. And that means you need younger workers and plenty of them to pay into the Social Security system to enable retired people to live a decent retired life.
In an upscale Beijing mall, Chinese husband and wife are working out in a trendy gym. Good break from their hectic jobs. They are the younger generation of Chinese who spend life tending to themselves rather than following the tradition of having babies. Eating out is also part of that spending time together without the burden of a child. These kinds of couples are worrying the Chinese government.
In big cities, that's a clear trend, right? It takes people a long time to be educated. After they graduate from the college, they have to look for jobs and have financial security before they establish family and raising children, right? So this process is long. So I think Chinese people are getting married at rather late stage, right? And now it's also quite a risky business to raise children in big cities.
It's time now for our in-depth section. Did you ever wonder how many babies are born into this world every day? Well, we're going to take a look at an interactive that shows how many babies are born on each continent, every second, every minute, and every hour that passes. Let's take a few seconds to check it out. There you have the continent breakdown, East Asia and Pacific, Europe and Central Asia, Latin America and Caribbean. Let's see who's in the lead right now. Looks like Sub-Saharan Africa is in the lead, 1520, 1593. And you can see the numbers, how rapidly they're progressing. Believe it or not, these are the children that are coming into this world. Now, let's break this down. This figure may astound you. Around 385,000 babies are born daily. And breaking it even further than that, we're going to look at a number that calculates per minute. That number is 270 daily births that are happening per minute. Well, here's the UN on the population numbers for the future.
From an estimated 2.5 billion people in 1950, the global population has grown more than threefold and now numbers around 7.7 billion. Using demographic and statistical methods, we have projected the global population forward to 2100. Our latest projections indicate that growth will continue and that the global population could number around 9.7 billion in 2050 and 10.9 billion in 2100.
Well, the question coming from the opponents are, with 270 babies born each minute, how many people can the Earth sustain? That is the key question. So many people coming into this world. I mean, are these numbers sustainable? On the one hand, there are critics that argue the population of the world has long since surpassed what they have called optimal levels. That's on the one hand. But there's another camp that's countering that. They are saying that consumption is as important as population levels. And then you have others that argue another case, that overpopulation is coming out of the poor parts of the world with large growth rates and not at richer regions, which use disproportionately high amounts of resources. Well, let's take a look at the truth. I mean, the truth really is that populations are declining. This warning, that is, was issued a long time ago by the UN, especially on how women had become more educated.
Gender equality and the empowerment of women are gaining ground worldwide. More people are living longer, are living healthier lives. More girls are in school. Fewer women are dying in pregnancy and childbirth. There are more laws to protect and uphold human rights.
And here is the former ECB Bank president, Mario Draghi, with his warning.
Euro area's working age population is projected to start gradually decreasing in the next decade. In that context, employment growth is likely to start decelerating in the not too distant future. Even with determined structural reforms, as a higher share of people in work will no longer be able to offset the fall in working age population.
You heard the words there, decelerating, decreasing. Okay, the key here lies in the young population. You just mentioned it there, when it comes to the economy. Now, the young population can contribute vastly to the economic advancement, provided the governments invest in education, healthcare, and jobs.
The world's young people now number a record 1.8 billion. Never before have there been so many people between the ages of 10 and 24. And never again is there likely to be so much potential for economic and social progress. While young people have the potential to change the world for the better, they can do it only if they're healthy, they're educated, their capabilities are developed, they have rights, they have a voice, and they have real opportunities and choices in life.
A lot of ifs there. Well, there are three predictors that contribute to the decline that we have been mentioning in fertility rates. The first predictor is urbanization. Housing is much cheaper in urban areas, like on a farm. A child is useful labor there, and housing is cheap. And in the city, there's less work, so as populations urbanize, their birth rates fall. Now, the second predictor is women's education, and basically the better educated a woman is, the less chances of her having children, because they are not great for careers. That's just how it goes. And the third one, believe it or not, is religion. The more religious you are, more chances you have of having more children. Okay, we need some clarification. We need some enlightenment here about some of the facts. Our guest, William Beeman, joins us. Now, William Beeman is an American scholar and a professor of anthropology at the University of Minnesota. He has authored many articles, 14 books on Iranian politics, theater, language, and culture. But William Beeman, welcome. The New York Times says all over the world, countries are confronting population stagnation, that there is a fertility bust, that's how they described it, a reversal, unmatched in recorded history. Obviously, this didn't happen overnight, and it wasn't because of COVID-19. What leading factors do you attribute for this phenomenon?
There are two factors that we need to take into account. First are biological factors, and I'll come back to that in a minute. The second are social factors, and the social factors are perhaps the most important aspect of this. In the world, only women can have children, and so changing patterns of employment and choices that women make about their lives have greatly impacted the birth rate of families throughout the world. Let me take Japan as a case. We've known that the population in Japan has been declining for some time. It used to be that unless a woman was married in Japan, she had no social role. In the 1970s, after a woman was 29, she could no longer actually even stay within the workplace. They would essentially fire her. because she wasn't young enough any longer.
India's population stands at approximately 1.38 billion people. The UN says its population might exceed China in the year 2028 to reach 1.45 billion.
The rising population is one of the biggest threats to our nation, as well as our universe also. And I don't know why the government has not taken any measure. I'm not particularly pointed any particular government right from the beginning.
The UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, when he was the mayor of London, once boasted about how the population in the UK, particularly London, was experiencing a population boom.
Growth is inevitable in London. London's the biggest city in Europe, in Western Europe anyway. It has huge population growth.
But things did not turn out that way. Brexit and COVID-19 dealt a blow to the population increases. But the UK is not alone. In all of the EU, the population is aging, while at the same time, birth rates are falling.
There definitely should be concern because early action is needed. But what we've shown is through myriad measures ranging from labour market participation to fiscal issues to solving vulnerability to poverty to combating the health challenge, countries can actually do a lot.
In Niger, the population is exploding. It is projected to increase from approximately 23 million in the year 2019 to around 30 million by 2030 and to reach 70 million by 2050. The reason? Religion. But the population boom has made many regions become food insecure. In Italy, the population decrease has reached a point where a town on the island of Sicily is selling off dozens of homes for just 1 euro to increase the population and to revitalize the economy. Japan has been experiencing a population decrease for quite some time. The number of births fell to a little over 8 million in the year 2020, down 2.8% from a year earlier, and the lowest since records began in 1899.
This will be a problem because it will affect Japan's society and economy. Last April, there was a report that the number of women are declining. Especially in the rural areas, the number of young women are decreasing. Therefore, it is said that the rural areas could disappear and become difficult to administer.
Time now for our Infant News section of the program, where we review some of the stories that we believe were worth mentioning here. Now, we've covered it before because it keeps popping its head in the news, and this is the story of the dollar. We call it the unfair dollar, and this means the U.S. dollar has political problems. Investment guru Jim Rogers has said that. Now, what they do is, according to him, the U.S. gets angry, and when it gets angry at you, they use sanctions, the Islamic Republic of Iran being the forefront of that. They say that you cannot use it. This is while international currency is supposed to be neutral. Well, that shows just the U.S. and how it treats the dollar as leverage. Next, G7 tax breakthrough is what was announced just days ago. The G7 nations reaching a historic deal on global tax reform. Well, the group of seven have backed a U.S. proposal that calls for corporations around the world to pay at least 15% on earnings. Now, the key word or the key phrase is at least. Why is that a key phrase? We're going to go to the next item to find out exactly what relevance that has. The relevance comes here. When it comes to U.S. taxes, well, you have six U.S. tech giants that paid almost $100 billion less in taxes from the years 2011 to 2020. That's the news that came out of the States. I mean, the U.S. needs to get its own house in order before it can claim success outside of its borders. That's just a recommendation. Well, we here at Economic Divide have brought you this story last month, and we will again highlight this very important development. It has to deal with food inflation. Global food prices have posted the biggest jump in a decade. By how much? The surge is quite a lot. If you take a look at it, it's going to come up in a second. You're looking at a surge that is in the area of 40% in the cost of agricultural commodities, which in turn has raised the specter of accelerating inflation. The fact that populations are declining is not a positive development. However, it's not the end of the world either. Shrinking populations generally tend not to have a middle ground. However, this is only a temporary state, albeit that it takes time for it to balance itself out. Countries have to learn to adapt themselves to the changing population landscape. Now, as we covered in this program, governments need to make sure that money and resources are spent especially in rural areas to make sure that mass urbanization doesn't take place or takes place at a moderate level. And finally, fair distribution of wealth needs to occur so that economic worry or costs are lessened. But how can that happen when the world's billionaires, around 2,000 of them, have more wealth than 4.6 billion people who make up 60% of the planet's population? That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. It was great having you. From Ikova Tafley, it's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا Sana.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are still looking at the human rights from an Islamic scope, or how Islam applied these Islamic laws or these human rights. Among the things that Islam done, it gave honor and respect to the human and animal life alike. And he said that a life has a value in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Not like what we see today, that life has no value whatsoever, that we use it for our entertainment. Have you seen Hollywood lately? Or have you seen games lately? It's based on killing. It's based on violence. The way to satisfy yourself and to pass your time and to be entertained and joyful is to watch how many people get killed, or you kill as many people as you can on these games. And this became an entertainment for us, to watch people get killed or we kill. Even though we say, well, it's not true, it's not real. Well, it's not real, but the concept is real. The concept of killing people is real. The more you watch, the more you play it yourself, the less value of a person becomes to you, the less it has a value. Why do you think American soldiers, they go around on a rampage in Iraq and other countries and just shooting people randomly? They done that in Gulf War too. Why? Because they were so brainwashed into it. And you can watch some documentaries, they are just sickening to the heart of the things that these soldiers used to do, these American soldiers used to do. Because they just feel like it, because, you know, they put music rock and roll and they put very hard music and they just go on a rampage. And that's because the concept of a human life, to them, it means nothing. So among the things that Islam came up with, he says, no, the human life has value. Not just that, even the animal life has value under the Islamic State. And we've all heard the story from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi, and he says a woman entered a hellfire because she had a cat and she kept her prisoner and she did not feed her and she did not give her water. And just for that, Allah sent this woman to hell for her actions. Also, I have another story which is similar, where the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam says, a woman or a man entered heaven because they quenched the thirst of a dog or a cat, depends on the story. So the idea and the moral of these stories, and there's many of them, is the fact that life, be it a human life or be it an animal life, Islam gave it a lot of value. And especially when it comes to coexisting with one another, that fact need to be taken into perspective. We need to keep that very clear to ourselves, that the human life is absolutely valuable. I cannot kill it. I cannot harm it physically or mentally or verbally. You cannot harm another human being or even another animal, which is considered to be inhumane. And in reference to what we see happens in other states, where if you find a government or a country that has superior power over another country, they will either invade them and kill them, or either they will deprive them of their natural resources. Now, let's leave it up to here, and inshallah we continue after the break.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program for humanity. We're still looking at the value of life from an Islamic perspective. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, in chapter Al-Ma'idah, verse 32, إِنَّهُ مَنْ قَتَلَ نَفْسًا بِغَيْرِ نَفْسٍ. He who kills a soul without taking retribution for another soul. So for example, if someone kills someone, the punishment is that he be killed. So if I kill someone, I need to be killed. This is just a punishment for killing. But if it wasn't that case, if it wasn't the case of me killing someone, it just comes and they just come and kill me. So Allah says, either you've killed someone, or فَسَادًا فِي الْأَرْضِ, that you create corruption on earth, فَكَأَنَّمَا قَتَلَ النَّاسَ جَمِيعًا. So if we come and kill an innocent person that has not killed people himself or committed atrocities and committed corruption on earth, then it is as if we have killed the entire humanity. That's how valuable a human life is. Now, if we look at it in our current state, you see, for example, America itself, their economy controls and it has its fingers and hands tight on the necks of other states who do not cooperate with them, and they put them under sanctions, and they make people suffer, and they make people die, and the people will have lack of medicine, lack of food, lack of everything, and they think that they are being humane. They haven't done anything wrong. And so we say, okay, where's the human rights in this aspect? You guys call for human rights, but yet you are happy to deprive millions of people of the basic needs because of your own thirst for power and your hunger for power, or because you want people to submit to your will and submit to your likings. That should not happen. So Islam says that should not happen. If you, by any way, means or form, you try to deprive a human being of his life or of the necessities of life, then you will face the wrath of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Then you would have killed many people, or all of them. So we see, for example, in America and in other countries, and even sadly in some Islamic countries, they produce, for example, too much of an item. For example, milk and wheat is get produced too much in America. In order for them to maintain the market and to maintain the prices of the market, anything that's surplus, anything that's an extra to the market, because if they push it to the market, then the prices would fall. So what they end up doing is that they end up throwing that milk and that wheat in the ocean just so that they keep the prices, or they burn the crops, or they even kill and slaughter the animals. And they say, well, they got, you know, like I remember in one country, they slaughtered so many chickens, and the excuse they gave because they got bird flu, which is nonsense. They were just trying to control the market. So they control the markets economically, and they starve people. When you have hundreds and thousands of people sleeping daily without food in their stomach, millions of people, I should say, starving without food, and you have thousands of children and people dying out of hunger because someone decided to keep the balance in the market, that's killing them all. So Islam says, no, everyone has a right, and this is the life of a human being or the life of an animal. It has greater value in Islam. It's respected, it's honored, and it needs to be looked that way as well. It should not be degraded. Inshallah, we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.